From PRI, Public Radio International.
You don't know what it's like to lose something forever, she said. It will make you do anything, even lie to people you love, if you think you can reclaim even a fraction of that thing. You don't know what fraction means. It means a little bit. It means a thing that's been broken into pieces.
You're listening to John Shea reading from Ann Beattie's What Was Mine, one of the stories on today's edition of Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. The first two stories on this program are from this year's shorts programs at The Mount, the home of Edith Wharton in Lenox, Massachusetts, in the lovely Berkshire Hills. Figuring that the weather in August might be very hot, we put together a program called Stories for the Dog Days. Meryl Marco's Conversations with My Dogs, the opening story, I hope will resonate not only with all you dog lovers listening out there, but also with Fido and Rex, who may be lying on the rug near you in your radio or with you in the car. After all, as you'll see, the story gives the dog's point of view as well. Patricia Callamber, reading Meryl Marco's A Conversation with My Dogs.
It is late afternoon. Seated at my desk, I call for my dogs to join me in my office. They do. Me. The reason I've summoned you here today is I really think we should talk about something. Bob. What's that? Me. Well, please don't take this the wrong way, but I get the feeling you guys think you have to follow me everywhere, and I just want you both to know that you don't. Stan. Where'd you get a feeling like that? Me. I get it from the fact that the both of you follow me everywhere all day long. Like, for instance, this morning, we were all together in the bedroom. Why do you look so blank? Doesn't this ring a bell at all? I was on the bed reading. Bob. Where was I? Me. On the floor sleeping. Bob. On the floor sleeping. Oh, yes, I remember. Go on. Me. So there came a point where I had to get up and go into the next room to get a Kleenex, and you both woke up out of a deep sleep to go with me. Stan. Yeah. So what's the problem? Bob, we like to watch you get Kleenex. We happen to think it's something you do very well. Me. The point I'm trying to make is, why do you both have to get up out of a deep sleep to go with me? You sit there staring at me all excited like you think something really good is going to happen. I feel a lot of pressure to be more entertaining. Bob, would it help if we stood? Stan, I think what the lady is saying is that where Kleenex retrieval is concerned, she'd just as soon we not make the trip. Bob, is that true? Me, yes, it is. Bob, oh man! Stan, don't let her get to you, buddy. Bob, I know it shouldn't, but it all comes as such a shock. Me, I think you may be taking this wrong. It's not that I don't like your company. It's just that I see no reason for you both to follow me every time I get up. Bob, what if just one of us goes? Stan. And I don't suppose that one of us would be you. Me. Neither of you needs to go. Bob, okay, fine, no problem. Get your damn Kleenex alone from now on. Me, good. Bob, I'm just curious. What's your position on pens? Me, pens? Bob, yes, how many of us can wake up out of a deep sleep to watch you look for a pen? Me, why would either of you want to wake up out of a deep sleep to follow me around while I'm looking for a pen? Stan, is she serious? Bob, I can't tell. She has such a weird sense of humor. Me, let's just level with each other, okay? The real reason you both follow me every place I go is that you secretly believe there might be food involved. Isn't that true? Isn't that the real reason for the show of enthusiasm? Stan, very nice talk. Bob, the woman has got some mouth on her. Me, you mean to deny that every time you follow me out of the room, it's actually because you think we're stopping for snacks? Bob, absolutely false. That is a bald-faced lie. We do it for the life experience. Stan, and sometimes I think it might work into a game of ball. Bob, but we certainly don't expect anything. Stan, we're way past expecting anything of you. We wouldn't want you to overexert yourself in any way. You have to rest and save up all your strength for all that Kleenex fetching. Bob, plus, we know it doesn't concern you in the least to know that we're starving to death. Stan, we consume, on the average, about a third of the calories eaten daily by the typical wasted South American street dog. Me, one bowl of food a day is what the vet said I should give you, no more. Bob, one bowl of food is a joke. It's an hors d'oeuvre. It does nothing but whet my appetite. Me, last summer, before I cut your food down, you were the size and shape of a hassock. Bob, who's she talking to? Stan, you, pal, you look like a beanbag chair, buddy. Bob, but it wasn't from overeating. In summer, I retain fluids, that's all. I was in very good shape. Stan, for a hippo. I saw you play ball back then. Nice energy. For a dead guy. Bob, oh, don't talk to me about energy. Who single-handedly ate his way through the back fence? Not just once, but four separate occasions. Me. So you're the one who did that. Bob. One who did what? Me. Ate through the back fence. Bob. Is there something wrong with the back fence? I have no idea what happened. Whoever said that is a liar. Stan. The fact remains that we are starving all day long and you continually torture us by eating right in front of us. Bob, very nice manners, by the way. Me, you have the nerve to discuss my manners? Who drinks out of the toilet and then comes up and kisses me on the face? Bob, that would be Dave. Me. No, that would be you. And while we're on the subject of manners, who keeps trying to crawl into the refrigerator? Who always has mud on their tongues? Stan. Well, that would be Dave. Me. Okay, that would be Dave. But the point I'm trying to make is that where manners are concerned, let's just say you don't catch me trying to stick my head in your dinner. Bob. Well, that may be more of a function of menu than anything else. Me. Which brings me back to the original point. The two of you do not have to wake up and offer me fake camaraderie now that you understand that once a day is all you're ever going to be fed, period, non-negotiable, for the rest of your natural lives. And if I want to play ball, I'll say so. End of sentence. Stan. Well, I guess the nature of these talks is completely broken down. Bob, I gotta tell you, it hurts. Stan, me, there's no reason to have hurt feelings. Stan, fine, whatever you say. Bob, I just don't give a damn anymore. I'm beyond that, quite frankly. Get your own damn Kleenex for all I care. Stan, I feel the same way. Let her go get all the Kleenex and pens she wants. I couldn't care less. Me. Excellent. Well, I hope we understand each other now. Bob, we do. Why'd you get up? Where are you going? Me. Into the next room. Stan. Oh, I see. And why's that? Me. To get my purse. Stan. Hey, fatso, get out of my way. Bob. Watch out, I was first. Stan, the hell you were, I was first. Bob, you, we're getting your purse. I go first, I'm starving. Stan, you don't listen at all, do you? Going for pens means food. She said she's getting her purse. That means ball.
Patricia Callenber read Meryl Marco's A Conversation with My Dogs. If pets and stories about pets enrich your life, get yourself a treat. The new Selected Shorts CD entitled Pets. Information at selectedshorts.org or audible.com. We turn now to a story read at the Mount by the other half of the husband and wife reading team of Patricia Callenber and Daniel Gerrell. The Saturday theme was gardens, both Edith Wharton's splendid gardens at the Mount and other people's gardens. Here Daniel Gerrell reads a story by H.H. Munro, or Saki, about a woman who won't let her run-down garden lower her social standing. The story is called The Occasional Garden.
Don't talk to me about town gardens, said Eleanor Rapsley. Which means, of course, that I want you to listen to me for an hour or so while I talk about nothing else. What a nice-sized garden you've got, people said to us when we first moved here. What I suppose they meant to say was, what a nice-sized site for a garden we've got. As a matter of fact, the size is all against it. It's too large to be ignored altogether and treated as a yard, and it's too small to keep giraffes in. You see, if we could keep giraffes or reindeer or some other species of browsing animal there, we could explain the general absence of vegetation by a reference to the fauna of the garden. And you can't have Wapiti and Darwin tulips, you know? So we didn't put down any bulbs last year. As it is, we haven't got the Wapiti, and the Darwin tulips haven't survived the fact that most of the cats of the neighbourhood hold a parliament in the centre of the tulip bed. That rather forlorn-looking strip that we intended to be a border of alternating geranium and spiraea has been utilised by the Cat Parliament as a division lobby. Snap decisions seem to have been rather frequent of late, far more frequent than geranium blooms are likely to be. I shouldn't object so much to ordinary cats, but I do complain of having a congress of vegetarian cats in my garden. They must be vegetarians, my dear, because whatever ravages they may commit among the sweet pea seedlings, they never seem to touch the sparrows. There are always just as many adult sparrows in the garden on Saturday as there were on Monday, not to mention newly fledged additions. There seems to have been an irreconcilable difference of opinion between sparrows and providence since the beginning of time as to whether a crocus looks best standing upright with its roots in the earth or in a recumbent posture with its stem neatly severed. The sparrows always have the last word in the matter. At least in our garden they do. I fancy that Providence must have originally intended to bring an amending act, or whatever it's called, providing either for a less destructive sparrow or a more indestructible crocus. The one consoling point about our garden is that it's not visible from the drawing room or the smoking room, so unless people are dining or lunching with us, they can't spy out the nakedness of the land. That is why I am so furious with Gwenda Pottingdon, who has practically forced herself on me for lunch on Wednesday next. She heard me offer the Paulcott girl lunch if she was up shopping on that day, and of course she asked if she might come too. She's only coming to gloat over my bedraggled and flowerless borders and to sing the praises of her own detestably over-cultivated gardener. I'm sick of being told that it's the envy of the neighbourhood. It's like everything else that belongs to her. Her car, her dinner parties, even her headaches. They're all superlative. No one else has ever had anything like them. When her eldest child was confirmed, it was such a sensational event, according to her account of it, that one almost expected questions to be asked about it in the House of Commons. And now she's coming on purpose to stare at my few miserable pansies and the gaps in my sweet pea border and to give me a glowing, full-length description of the rare and sumptuous blooms in her rose garden. My dear Eleanor, said the Baroness, you should save yourself all this heart-burning and a lot of gardener's bills, not to mention sparrow anxieties, simply by paying an annual subscription to the OOSA. I never heard of it, said Eleanor. What is it? The Occasional Oasis Supply Association, said the Baroness. It exists to meet cases exactly like yours. Cases of backyards that are of no practical use for gardening purposes, but are required to blossom into decorative scenic backgrounds at stated intervals. When a luncheon or dinner party is contemplated, supposing, for instance, you have people coming to lunch at 1:30, you just ring up the association at about 10 o'clock the same morning and say, lunch garden. That is all the trouble you have to take. By 12:45, your yard is carpeted with a strip of velvety turf, with a hedge of lilac or red may, or whatever happens to be in season. As a background, one or two cherry trees in blossom and clumps of heavily flowered rhododendrons filling in the corners. In the foreground, you have a blaze of carnations or Shirley poppies or tiger lilies in full bloom. As soon as the lunch is over and your guests have departed, the garden departs also. And all the cats in Christendom can sit in council in your yard without causing you a moment's anxiety. If you have a bishop or an antiquary or something of that sort coming to lunch, you just mention the fact when you are ordering the garden, and you get an old-world pleasance with clipped yew hedges and a sundial and hollyhocks and perhaps a mulberry tree, borders of sweet williams and Canterbury bells, and an old-fashioned beehive or two tucked away in a corner. Those are the ordinary lines of supply that the Oasis Association undertakes, but by paying a few guineas a year extra, you are entitled to its emergency EON service. What on earth is an EON service? It's just like a conventional signal to indicate special cases like the incursion of Gwenda Pottingdon. It means you've got someone coming to lunch or dinner whose garden is alleged to be the envy of the neighbourhood. Yes! Exclaimed Eleanor. Exclaimed Eleanor with some excitement. And what happens then? Something that sounds like a miracle out of the Arabian Nights. Your backyard becomes voluptuous with pomegranate and almond trees, lemon groves, and hedges of flowering cactus, dazzling banks of azaleas, marble basined fountains in which chestnut and white pond herons step daintily amid exotic water lilies, while golden pheasants strut about on alabaster terraces. The whole effect rather suggests the idea that Providence and Norman Wilkinson had dropped mutual jealousies and collaborated to produce a background for an open-air Russian ballet. In point of fact, it is merely the background to your luncheon party. If there is any kick left in Gwenda Pottingdon, or whoever your EON guest of the moment may be, just mention carelessly that your climbing putella is the only one in England since the one at Chatsworth died last winter. There isn't such a thing as a climbing putella, but Gwenda Pottingdon and her kind don't usually know one flower from another without prompting. Quick, said Eleanor, the address of the association. Gwenda Pottingdon did not enjoy her lunch. It was a simple yet elegant meal, excellently cooked and daintily served, but the piquant sauce of her own conversation was notably lacking. She had prepared a long succession of eulogistic comments on the wonders of her town garden with its unrivaled effects of horticultural magnificence, and, behold, her theme was shut in on every side by the luxuriant hedge of Siberian berberis that formed a glowing background to Eleanor's bewildering fragment of fairyland, the pomegranate and lemon trees, the terraced fountain where golden carp slithered and wriggled amid the roots of gorgeous hued irises, the banked masses of exotic blooms, the pagoda-like enclosure where Japanese sand badgers disported themselves. All these contributed to take away Gwenda's appetite and moderate her desire to talk about gardening matters. I can't say I admire the climbing putella, she observed shortly. And anyway, it's not the only one of its kind in England. I happen to know of one in Hampshire. How gardening is going out of fashion. I suppose people haven't the time for it nowadays. Altogether, it was quite one of Eleanor's most successful luncheon parties. It was distinctly an unforeseen catastrophe that Gwenda should have burst in on the household 4 days later at lunchtime and made her way unbidden into the dining room. I thought I must tell you that my Elaine has had a watercolour sketch accepted by the Latent Talent Art Guild. It's to be exhibited at their summer exhibition at the Hackney Gallery. It will be the sensation of the moment in the art world. Hello? What on earth has happened to your garden? It's not there. Suffragettes, said Eleanor promptly. Didn't you hear about it? They broke in and made hay of the whole thing in about 10 minutes. I was so heartbroken at the havoc that I had the whole place cleared out. I shall have it laid out again on rather more elaborate lines. That, she said to the Baroness afterwards, is what I call having an emergency brain.
Daniel Gerald read Saki's The Occasional Garden. We'll be back in a minute with John Shea reading a powerful story by Anne Beattie. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, recorded live at Symphony Space in New York City. Symphony Space's season is sponsored by Zabar's, offering the nation a taste of New York. Coffee, gourmet foods, and gift baskets available online at zabars.com. Ann Beatty was the winner of the prestigious Ray Award for the short story in 2005. Her gripping tale, What Was Mine, was read in 2006 at a Symphony Space evening called Patriots and Saints. It's from Beatty's collection, Park City, New and Selected Stories. It's a story about a mother and her son who is coping with the memory of his father and the reality of a new man in his mother's life. The reader is John Shea.
I don't remember my father. I have only two photographs of him. One of two soldiers standing with their arms around each other's shoulders, their faces even paler than their caps, so that it's difficult to make out their features. The other of my father in profile, peering down at me in my crib. In that photograph, he has no discernible expression, though he does have a rather noble Roman nose and thick hair that would have been very impressive if it hadn't been clipped so short. On the back of the picture in profile is written, unaccountably, Guam, while on the back of the picture of the soldiers it says, Happy with Baby, 5/28/49. Until I was 5 or 6, I had no reason to believe that Herb was not my uncle. I might have believed that much longer if my mother had not blurted out the truth one night when I opened her bedroom door and saw Herb, naked from the waist down, crouched at the foot of the bed, holding out a bouquet of roses, much the way teasing people shake a biscuit in front of a sleeping dog's nose. They had been to a wedding earlier that day, and my mother had caught the nosegay. Herb was tipsy, but I had no sense of that then. Because I was a clumsy boy, I didn't wonder about his occasionally knocking into a wall or stepping off a curb a bit too hard. He was not allowed to drive me anywhere, but I thought only that my mother was full of arbitrary rules she imposed on everyone. No more than 1 hour of TV a day, put Bosco in the glass first, then the milk. One of the most distinct memories of my early years is of that night I opened my mother's door and saw Herb lose his balance and fall forward on the bouquet like a thief clutching bread under his shirt. Ethan, my mother said, I don't know what you're doing in here at a time when you're supposed to be in bed and without the manners to knock, but I think the time has come to tell you that Herbert and I are very close, but not close in the way family members such as a brother and sister are. Herbert is not your uncle, but you must go on as if he were. Other people should not know this. Well, Herb had rolled onto his side. As he listened, he began laughing. He threw the crushed bouquet free, and I caught it by taking one step forward and waiting for it to land in my outstretched hand. It was the way Herb had taught me to catch a ball, because I had a tendency to overreact and rush too far forward too fast. By the time I had caught the bouquet, exactly what my mother said had become a blur. Manners, Herbert, not family, don't say anything. Herb rolled off the bed, stood, and pulled on his pants. I had the clear impression that he was in worse trouble than I was. I think that what he said to me was that his affection for me was just what it always had been, even though he wasn't actually my uncle. I know that my mother threw a pillow at him and told him not to confuse me, and then she looked at me and said emphatically that Herb was not part of our family. And after saying that, she became quite flustered and got up and stomped out of the bedroom, slamming the door behind her. Herb gave the door a dismissive wave of the hand. Alone with him, I felt much better. I suppose I had thought that he might vanish. If he was not my uncle, he might just suddenly disappear, so that his continued presence was very reassuring. Don't worry about it, he said. The divorce rate is climbing. People are itching to change jobs every 5 minutes. And you wait, Dwight Eisenhower is going to be reevaluated. He won't have the same position in history that he has today. He looked at me. He sat on the side of the bed. Hey, I'm your mother's boyfriend, he said. She doesn't want to marry me. It doesn't matter. I'm not going anywhere. You just keep it between us that I'm not your Uncle Herb. My mother was tall and blonde, the oldest child of a German family that had immigrated to America in the 1920s. Herb was dark-haired, the only child of a Lebanese father and his much younger English bride, who had considered, even on the eve of her wedding, leaving the Church of England to convert to Catholicism to become a nun. In retrospect, I realized that my mother's shyness about her height and her having been indoctrinated to believe that the hope of the future lay in her accomplishing great things, and Herb's self-consciousness about his kinky hair, along with his attempt as a child to negotiate peace between his mother and father, resulted in an odd bond between Herb and my mother. She was drawn to his conciliatory nature, and he was drawn to her no-nonsense attitude. Or perhaps she was drawn to his unusual amber eyes, and he was taken in by her inadvertently sexy, self-conscious girlishness. Maybe he took great pleasure in shocking her, in playing to her secret, more sophisticated desires, and she was secretly amused and gratified that he took it as a given that she was highly competent and did not have to prove herself to him in any way whatsoever. She worked in a bank. He worked in an automotive section at Sears Roebuck. And on the weekend, he played piano, harmonica, and sometimes tenor sax at a bar off Pennsylvania Avenue called the Merry Mariner. On Saturday nights, my mother and I would sit side by side, dressed in our good clothes, in a booth upholstered in blue naga hide, behind which dangled nets that were nailed to the wall, studded with starfish, conch shells, seahorses, and clamshells with small painted scenes or decals inside them. I had to work out a way of seeming to be looking in front of me and listening appreciatively to Uncle Herb, while at the very same time rolling my eyes upward to take in those tiny depictions of sunsets, rainbows, and ships sailing through the moonlight. Uncle Herb played a slowish version of Let Me Call You Sweetheart on the harmonica, as I sipped my cherry Coke with real cherries in it, three, because the waitress liked me. He played As Time Goes By on the piano, singing so quietly it seemed he was humming. My mother and I always split the fisherman's platter, four shrimp, one crab cake, and a lobster tail, or sometimes two if the owner wasn't in the kitchen, though my mother often wrapped up the lobster tails and saved them for our Sunday dinner. She would slice them and dish them up over rice, along with the tomato and lettuce salad she served almost every night. Some of Uncle Herb's songs would go out to couples celebrating an anniversary, or to birthday boys, or to women being courted by men who preferred to let Uncle Herb sing the romantic thoughts. They hesitated to speak. Once, during the evening, Herb would dedicate a song to my mother, always referring to her as my own special someone, and nodding but never looking directly toward our booth. My mother kept the beat to the faster tunes by tapping her finger on the shiny, varnished tabletop. During the slow number, she would slide one finger back and forth against the edge of the table, moving her hand so delicately she might have been testing the blade of a knife. Above her blonde curls, I would see miniature versions of what I thought must be the most exotic places on earth, so exotic that any reference to them would quicken the heart of anyone familiar with the mountains of Hawaii or the seas of Bora Bora. My mother smoked cigarettes, so sometimes I would see these places through fog. When the overhead lights turned from blue to pink as Uncle Herb played the last set, they would be transformed to the most ideal possible versions of paradise. I was hypnotized by what seemed to me their romantic clarity as Herb sang a bemused version of Stormy Weather, and then picked up the saxophone for Green Eyes, and finished always with a Billie Holiday song he would play very simply on the piano without singing. And then the lights went to a dusky red and gradually brightened to a golden light that seemed as stupefying to me as the cloud rising at Los Alamos must have seemed to the observers of Trinity. It allowed people enough light to judge their sobriety, pay the bill, or decide to postpone functioning until later and vanish into the darker reaches of the bar at the back. Uncle Herb never patted me on the shoulder or tousled my cowlick. He usually sank down next to my mother, still bowing slightly to acknowledge the applause. And then he reached over with the same automatic motion my mother used when she withdrew a cigarette from the pack to run his thumb over my knuckles as if he were testing a keyboard. If a thunderbolt had left his fingers, it could not have been more clear. He wanted me to be a piano player. That plan had to be abandoned when I was 13. Or perhaps it did not really have to be abandoned, but at the time, I found a convenient excuse to let go of the idea. One day, as my mother rounded a curve in the rain, the car skidded into a telephone pole. As the windshield splattered into cubes of glass, my wrist was broken and my shoulder dislocated. My mother was not hurt at all, though when she called Herb at work, she became so hysterical that she had to be given an injection in the emergency room before he arrived to take us both away. I don't think that she was ever really the same after the accident. Looking back, I realized that that was when everything started to change, though there was every chance that my adolescence and her growing hatred for her job might have changed things anyway. My mother began to seem irrationally angry at Herb, and so solicitous of me that I felt smothered. I held her responsible suddenly for everything, and I had a maniac's ability to transform good things into something awful. The five cherries I began to get in my Coke seemed an unwanted pollution, and I was sure that my mother had told the waitress to be extra kind. Her cigarette smoke made me cough. Long before the Surgeon General warned against the dangers of smoking, I was sure that she meant to poison me. When she drove me to physical therapy, I misconstrued her positive attitude and was sure that she took secret delight in having me tortured. My wrist set wrong and had to be put in a cast a second time. My mother cried constantly. I turned to Herb to help me with my homework. She relented, and he became the only one who drove me everywhere. When I started being skeptical of my mother, she began to be skeptical of Herb. I heard arguments about the way he arranged his sets. She said that he should end on a more upbeat note. She thought the lighting was too stagey. He began to play and end in a nondescript silver glow. I looked at the shells on the netting, not caring that she knew I wasn't concentrating on Herb's playing. She sank lower in the booth, and her attention also drifted. No puffs of smoke carefully exhaled in the pauses between sung phrases. No testing the edge of the table with her fingertip. And one Saturday night, we just stopped going. By that time, she had become a loan officer at Riggs Bank. Herb had moved from Sears to Montgomery Ward, where he was in charge of the lawn and leisure activities section, everything from picnic tables to electric hedge clippers. She served TV dinners. She complained that there wasn't enough money, though she bought expensive high heels that she wore to work. On Wednesday nights, Herb played handball with friends who used to be musicians, but who were suddenly working white-collar jobs to support growing families. He would come home and say, either with disbelief or with disorientation, that Sal, who used to play in a Latino band, had just had twins, or that Earl had sold his drums and bought an expensive barbecue grill. She read Perry Mason. He read magazine articles about the Second World War, articles, he said, shaking his head, they were clearly paving the way for a reassessment of the times in which we lived. I didn't have a friend, a real friend, until I was 14. And that was the year I met my soulmate, a boy named Ryuji Anderson, who shared my passion for soccer and introduced me to Playboy. He told me to buy kids one size too large and stuff a sock in the toes so that I could kick hard and the ball would really fly. We both suffered because we sensed that you had to look like John F. Kennedy to be John F. Kennedy. Ryuji's mother had been a war bride, and my mother had lost her husband 6 years after the war in a freak accident. A painter on scaffolding had lost his footing high up and tumbled backward to the ground, releasing as he fell a can of paint that struck my father on the head and killed him. The painter faithfully sent my mother a Christmas card every year, informing her about his own slow recovery and apologizing for my father's death. Uncle Herb met my mother when his mother, dead of leukemia, lay in the room adjacent to my father's room in the funeral home. They had coffee together one time when they were both exiled to the streets late one night. And it was not until a year later, when he looked her up in the phone book, the number was still listed under my father's name, that he saw her again. That time I went along and was bought a paper cone filled with French fries. I played cowboy, circling the bench on which they sat with an imaginary lasso. We had stumbled on a carnival. Since it was downtown Washington, it wasn't really a carnival, but a small area of the mall taken over by dogs who had jumped through burning hoops and clowns on roller skates. It became a standing refrain between my mother and Herb that some deliberate merriment had been orchestrated just for them, like the play put on in A Midsummer Night's Dream. I, of course, had no idea what to make of the world on any given day. My constants were that I lived with my mother, who cried every night, that I could watch only 2 shows on TV each day, and that I would be put to bed earlier than I wanted with a nightlight left burning. That day that my mother and Herb sat on the bench, I'm sure I sensed that things were going to be different as I inscribed 2 people destined to be together in an imaginary lassoed magic circle. From then on, we were a threesome. He moved in as a boarder. He lived in the room that used to be the dining room, which my mother and I never used since we ate off TV trays. I remember his hanging a drapery rod over the arch, nailing in the brackets, lifting up the bar, pushing onto it the brocade curtain that my mother had sewn, and then lowering the bar into place. They giggled behind it. And then they slid the curtain back and forth as if testing to see if it would really work. It was like one of the games I had had as a baby, a board with a piece of wood that slid back and forth, exposing first the sun and then the moon. Of course, late at night, they cheated. He would simply push the curtain aside and go to her bed. Since I would have accepted anything, it's a wonder they didn't just tell me. A father, an uncle, a saint, howdy-doody, lassie. I didn't have any very clear idea of how any of them truly behaved. I believed what I saw. And looking back, I can only assume that they were afraid not so much of what I would think as what others might think, and that they were unwilling to draw me into their deception. Until I wandered into her bedroom, they were simply not going to blow their cover. They were just going to wait for me. Eventually, I was sure to stumble into their world. The secret about Uncle Herb doesn't go any farther than this house, my mother said that night after I found them together. She was quite ashen. We stood in the kitchen. I had followed her, not because I loved her so much, or because I trusted her, but because I was already sure of Herb. Sure because even if he had winked at me, he could not have been clearer about the silliness of the slammed door. She had on a beige nightgown and was backlit by the counterlight. She cast a pond-like shadow on the floor. I would like to say that I asked her why she had lied to me, but I'm sure I wouldn't have dared. Imagine my surprise when she told me anyway, You don't know what it's like to lose something forever, she said. It will make you do anything, even lie to people you love, if you think you can reclaim even a fraction of that thing. You don't know what fraction means. It means a little bit. It means a thing that's been broken into pieces. I knew that she was talking about loss. All week I'd been worried that the bird at school with its broken wing might never fly again, would hop forever in the cardboard box. What my mother was thinking of, though, was that can of paint. A can of paint that she wished had missed my father's head and sailed into infinity. We looked down at the sepia shadow. It was there in front of her and in front of me. And, of course, it was behind us, too. Many years later, the day Herb took me out for a talk, we drove aimlessly for quite a while. I could almost feel Herb's moment of inspiration when it finally came. And he went around a traffic circle and headed down Pennsylvania Avenue. It was a Saturday, and on Saturdays, the Merry Mariner was only open for dinner, but he had a key, and so we parked and went inside and turned on a light. It was not one of those lights that glowed when he played, but a strong fluorescent light. Herb went to the bar and poured himself a drink. He opened a can of Coke and handed it to me. And then he told me that he was leaving us. He said that he himself found it unbelievable. And then suddenly he began to urge me to listen to Billie Holiday's original recordings, to pay close attention to the paintings of Vermeer, to look around me and to listen, to believe that what to some people might seem the silliest sort of place might be, to those truly observant, a temporary substitute for heaven. I was a teenager. I was too embarrassed to cry. I sat on a bar stool. I simply looked at him. That day, neither of us knew how my life would turn out. Possibly, he thought, that so many unhappy moments would have damaged me forever. For all either of us knew, he had been the father figure to a potential hoodlum, or even to a drifter. That was what the game of pretense he and my mother had been involved in might have produced. He shook his head sadly when he poured another drink. Later, I found out that my mother had asked him to go. But that day, I didn't even think to ask why I was being abandoned. Before we left the restaurant, he told me, as he had the night I found him naked in my mother's room, how much he cared for me. He also gave me practical advice about how to assemble a world. He had been the one who suggested that the owner string netting on the walls. First, he and the owner had painted the ocean. Pale blue, more shine than paint at the bottom, everything larger than it appeared on land. And then gradually, the color of the paint changed. Rays of light streamed in, and things took on a truer size. Herb had added on one of the walls phosphorescence. He had touched the paintbrush to the wall delicately, repeatedly, meticulously. He was a very good amateur painter. Those who sat below it would never see it, though. Those who sat adjacent to it might see the glow in their peripheral vision. From across the room where my mother and I sat, the highlights were too delicate and too far away to see. The phosphorescence had never caught my eye when my thoughts drifted from the piano music or when I blinked my eyes to clear them of the smoke. The starfish had been bought in lots of a dozen from a store in Chinatown. The clamshells had been painted by a woman who lived in Arlington in the suburbs, who had once strung them together as necklaces for church bazaars until the demand dried up and macrame was all the rage. And then she sold them to the owner of the restaurant, who carried them away from her yard sale in two aluminum buckets years before he ever imagined he would open a restaurant. Before Herb and I had left the Merry Mariner that day, there wasn't anything about how the place had been assembled that I didn't know. 15 years after that, I drove with my fiancé to Herb's cousin's house to get some things he'd left with her for safekeeping in case anything happened to him. His cousin was a short, unattractive woman who lifted weights. She had converted what had been her dining room into a training room, complete with Nautilus, rowing machine, and barbells. She lived alone, so there was no one to slide the curtain back for. There was no child, so she was not obliged to play at anything. She served us iced tea with big slices of lemon. She brought out guacamole and a bowl of tortilla chips. She had called me several days before to say that Herb had had a heart attack and had died. And though I would not find out formally until some time later, she also told me that Herb had left money in his will. He also asked that she pass on to me a large manila envelope. She handed it to me, and I was so curious that I opened it immediately on the back porch of some muscle-bound woman named Frances in Cold Spring Harbor, New York. There was sheet music inside. 6 Billie Holiday songs that I recognized immediately as Herb's favorites for ending the last set of an evening. There were several notes, which I suppose you could call love notes, from my mother. There was a tracing on a food-stained Merry Mariner placemat of a cherry, complete with stem, and a fancy pencil-drawn frame around it that I vaguely remembered Herb having drawn one night. There was also a white envelope that contained 2 pictures, one of the soldiers on Guam, one of a handsome young man looking impassively at a sleeping young baby. And I knew the second that I saw it that he was my father. I was fascinated. But the more I looked at it, the more remote and expressionless the man seemed. The more it began to dawn on me that Herb wanted me to see the picture of my father because he wanted me to see how different he had been from him. And when I turned the picture of my father in profile and read Guam, I almost smiled. It certainly wasn't my mother's handwriting. It was Herb's, though he had tried to slope the letters so that it would resemble hers. What sweet revenge, he must have thought, to leave me with the impression that my mother had been such a preoccupied, scattered-brained woman that she could not even label 2 important pictures correctly. My mother had died years before of pneumonia. The girl that I had been dating at the time had said to me, not unkindly, that although I was very sad about my mother's death, one of the advantages of time passing was sure to be that the past would truly become the past. Words would become suspect. People would seem only to be poor souls struggling to do their best. Images would fade. Not the image of the wall painted to look like the ocean, though. She was wrong about that. Herb had painted it exactly the way it really looks. I had found this out later when I went snorkeling, and I saw the world underwater for the first time, with all its spooky spots of overexposure and shimmering irregularities. But how tempting, how reassuring to offer people the possibility of climbing from deep water to the surface by moving upward on lovely white nets, gigantic ladders from which no one need ever topple. On Francis's porch, as I stared at the photographs of my father, I saw him as a young man on a hot island, his closest friend, a tall broomstick of a man whom he would probably never see again once the war was over. He was a hero. He had served his country. When he got off Guam, he would have a life. Things didn't turn out the way he expected, though. The child he left behind was raised by another man, although it is true that his wife missed him forever and remained faithful in her own strange way by never remarrying. And as I continued to look at the photograph, though, it was not possible to keep thinking of him as a hero. He was an ordinary man, romantic in context, a sad young soldier on a tropical island that would soon become a forgotten land. When the war was over, he would have a life, but a life that was much too brief, and the living would never really recover from that tragedy. Herb must also have believed that he was not a hero. That must have been what he was thinking when he wrote in wispy letters brief transposed captions for the two pictures that did not truly constitute any legacy at all. In Cold Spring Harbor, as I put the pictures back in the envelope, I realized that no one had spoken for quite some time. Frances tilted her glass, shaking the ice cubes. She hardly knew us. Soon we would be gone. It was just a quick drive to the city, and she would see us off, knowing that she had discharged her responsibility by passing on to me what Herb had said was mine.
John Shea reading What Was Mine by Ann Beattie. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.